Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Form Zen Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, protecting the history, one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Aloha, everybody. Happy
Aloha.
Holidays. Happy holidays to everybody that's out there who's listening. My name is Professor Gary Lee, and we're the AMAA Masters Radio Show and Network. And we're really excited about being in your home tonight on this Tuesday night. In some parts of the United States, I'm sure it's very cold. In Texas, it's fixing to get cold. We got a front that just came in. And so we're bundling up here, getting ready for a hard 35-degree weather that we'll be hitting tomorrow. I've got a really unique show tonight. And, you know, as you know, that most of you that keep up with the show, is that I normally interview people that I go back with 20, 30 years, and there's no exception tonight. Tonight I have a very special guest, someone I go back to the very first early days of the NBL, in fact, the beginning of the National Black Belt League. And I'll be bringing him on here in a few minutes. And that person is not only a personal friend of me personally, but he's also a history journalist for the Sport Karate Museum and a superstar considered in Canada martial arts. And, of course, I'm talking about Hansi Scott Ogard. So we'll be bringing him on in just a few minutes. But before we do, I want to make a couple shout-outs and, talk a little bit about what we're about for the new listeners who may be listening for the first time. You know, the heart of our show is a book that I got involved with a few years back. It's called Who's in Martial Arts. And it was actually started by a gentleman named, two people, Dale Brooks and Jan Waldo. And one of their students, Hansi Jesse Bowen, who happens to produce this radio program and also the producer of the network, has taken on to take the responsibility of his instructors who created it and take it to the next level. So, you know, the book is really unique and it's different. And we encourage you to check it out. If you'd like to, you can go to Barnes & Noble, or you can go to Century Martial Arts and Fitness, or you can check it out on Amazon.com. Or you can call Jesse Bowen directly, Hansi Jesse Bowen directly, and that number is 919-618-8076. And basically the book tells your story of what you did in the martial arts to come and be a part of it. And we're international now. We're getting people involved with from Canada and Mexico. And so we're really excited about this. And when I say it's a full package, you're not only part of the book, but you're part also of the Legends event that they have every year. And last year they had in Washington, D.C., and they honored Master June Reedy. You also have eligible for a beautiful ring that's part of the process. But like I said, it's unique and different. And it's the heart of this program because it allowed me to talk to pioneers and legends and people that created sport karate in America. And our show is based upon that basis of talking to those incredible people that created it or created martial arts or sport martial arts in the way that we love it. You know, so with that said, please, if you're interested, please look up the Who's in the Martial Arts and find out what it's about. You know, we're really excited about it being the holiday season. And the reason why I'm excited about it is we're coming up in two more shows. We've been on the air for 1 year. 1 year, Hansi Jesse Bowen and Kirk Corley and, they took a chance and asked me to be a part of this. And I was never hesitant, especially when he mentioned Mr. Corley, because, you know, he's been a mentor of the museum from the beginning. But I never believed I would do it every week. Every week I've been in your homes and talking sport martial arts. And I love doing that because the Sport Karate Museum is based upon that. You know, protecting the history, one warrior at a time. That's really what it is. That's our motto. That's what we do. And for more interested people or you're interested in getting involved, please go to www.sportkaratemuseum.org and check out the website, or you can call me directly at 713-483-0476. You know, the man that I'm talking to tonight, Mr. Scott Hogarth, goes back a long ways, and I'll just talk about the history that I knew of him. I actually heard of him through the ratings because he was the number one competitor in his region up in Canada. And but before I got to know him as an arbitrator and as someone who had authority in the martial arts and that level, I knew him as a competitor. And that was interesting. But then later on, when I went to the first Super Grands in 1992, I found out he was a very, very important person as far as helping with the rules, making the rules work. And I understood what an arbitrator was because he was actually the first arbitrator for the National Black Belt League. He is actually not only a world champion as far as the martial arts goes, but he won the world championships way before a lot of these other championships were so-called world championships. Now, on top of that, he's a very traditional martial artist. And you're going to find out in this interview, he's very personable, very special individual. And I'm very excited tonight to interview, and my third show being a whole year on the air, Mr. Scott Hogarth, and we actually call him Hunty Scott Hogarth. So with that said, Mr. Hogarth, are you there, sir?
I am so, Gary Lee. How are you, my brother?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. I'm so excited about having you and talking to you about karate tonight on this show. You know, we do go back a long time, so with permission, may I call you what I always call you, either Scotty or Hunchy. Which one would you be more comfortable with?
Hey, brother, you always call me Scotty. If you call me Hunchy, Hunchy is a title that you don't need to use.
Thank you.
So
thank
it's special
you.
For my students,
right?
Hey?
You always ask permission, right?
Yeah, well, you can do that with me, but you know.
Yes.
It's always been Scotty. It always will be.
Well, you know, it's important, I think, for the listeners to understand that when two old guys, and we are two old guys who've known each other for a long time, even what we do and what we've done and what we're doing, we still remember the etiquette of asking permission. And I know that's important to you, too. And it's been kind of that way from the very beginning since our relationship. But, you know, let's talk about you for a minute. I want to talk about how you got started. Who was your first influence? And what year did you actually make black belt?
Oh, wow. My very first influence was Isayu Yabunaka. Isayu Yabunaka had a very tiny dojo on East Hastings Street in Vancouver. And I was walking along East Hastings Street not feeling too good about myself because I spent a lot of time doing things I probably shouldn't be doing, especially at 19, 20, 21. You know, I was out there, right? And I was looking for something, and this man represented it for me. I watched him do a form on his floor, and I knocked on his door, and I asked him if I could come in, and he said, height. And I asked him if he would teach me, and he said, height. And I asked him what time I should come back, and he said, hi. And suddenly I realized that the only word he knew, or I knew, was hi, meaning yes.
<That's right.
laughs> He knew virtually no English. And the rest is history. We became great friends. I trained every day. I trained there, and I went down to a place called the Green Door on East Hastings Street. East Hastings was a bit rough. And I used to go down to the Kung Fu place and do some nunchaku as well. It was great. It was a wonderful time. My first influence in martial arts was spectacular. I love him dearly, and I know him today.
Did you make black belt
Sorry?
Did you make black belt under that gentleman?
No, sir, I did not. I got the green belt under that man.
Okay. How did you make black belt under?
I went to a guy named Monty Guest. Monty is one of the original Soroka black belts. He's one of the main teachers that has come out of Canada. He runs the Kaishin organization, and I joined Kaishin because I had some friends that trained there. And I loved it. Kaishin was very unique. We weren't all about kata back then. We were like 15 minutes of kata, which gave us the right to fight for an hour and a half. So that's kind of the way the club went. It was a very strong fighting club, and I made black belt.
So that's
under,
where you made first degree black belt under Kaishin.
Yeah, under Monty Guest.
Okay, now when did you get in Okinawa influence? What year was that?
Oh man, my Okinawa influence. That's a good story. Do you know my good friend Frank Hargrove?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very well.
Okay. Well, here I am. I'm a fourth degree black belt in Cheetaroo, and Frank Hargrove is out in the audience, and I think it was Steel Bell's tournament, and I'm out performing, and I think I won a couple of things, and this big man comes up to me, and he goes, "Yeah, man," he says, "you do really good karate. Too bad it's not real." Well, I almost hooked him, man. What do you mean it's not real? I've been doing this for years now. This is now 1989, started in 1973. You know, what are you telling me? And he looks at me and he says, no, he says, that's not what I mean. He said, I train from Okinawa, and that's the origins of karate, and that's what I do. And I said, well, when are you going back? And he said, well, the end of the month. And I said, okay, I'll be coming to see you. Can I train with you for a couple of weeks before we go? He said, yes. I trained with him for 2 weeks, and I went to Okinawa. When I got there, he took me to the Kaki no Hana Dojo. It was a Shorin Rugai, and kind of dropped me off, introduced me to Morihiro Yagi, who was a direct descendant of Meitoku Yagi. He's one of his cousins. And I said, okay, I want to do Goju. Who do I train with here? Who do I go and see? So Kaki no Hana and Yagi-san took me to the Toyama home dojo, and they introduced me to Toyama Zenshu Sensei, Shinjikan. And, wow, this man was small, compact, and extremely impressive. His Goju-ryu was amazing. I just watched him do a few moves, and I went, okay, this is the guy I want to train with.
Was he descended on the Yamashita?
Sorry?
Yamaguchi, Goshi Yamaguchi?
No, man. He was a direct student of Taguchi-sensei and a direct student of Seiko Higa-sensei. He's one of the few people that did train with Chojin Miyagi as well.
He's
one of the few surviving people that still of that generation. He's 82 years of age now.
Where did Goshin Yamaguchi come in his style of Goju?
Yamaguchi, that's Gojin Yamaguchi, that's Japanese Goju-ryu. That's
okay.
What I started
Okinawa Goju. Okinawan Goju. Now, explain to the listeners the difference between Japanese Goju from Yamaguchi to Okinawa Goju from your system.
Wow. Well, the Okinawan Goju is the original Goju-ryu. Yamaguchi traveled to Okinawa to learn, and he learned from one of Chojin Miyagi's black belts and pretty spectacular organization he put together. His organization, what he ran back in the day, there are many branches now of Japanese Goju-ryu karate.
So when Yamaguchi did his style of Goju-ryu and he formed Nishi Goju-ryu, that was an off branch of what he learned in Okinawa?
Yes. Well,
he
put that together himself, right? So
okay.
A lot of his stuff has the influence of yoga in it because he was a yoga man, right?
Okay.
So you'll see the breathing, and for instance, the Ibuki breathing in Okinawan Goju is only in one kata. It's only
so
in
what's
Sanchin.
The difference in Ibuki breathing and Sanchin breathing? Sanchin breathing.
The name.
That's it. Okay.
Ibuki is the breathing that you do when you do Sanchin kata. The only kata in Okinawan Goju that you use Ibuki breathing in is Sanchin. because it's not for the student. The kata is not for the student at all. It's for the sensei. So he knows that you can do the technique, which is resist pressure, resist punching, and learn how to breathe properly.
Okay, before we get into the technical, which we can talk about all night, I want to talk a little bit about more about competition. I love talking about our history. And I remember in Galveston, and I'll let you tell the story, how we met, how we actually first met. This was before Super Grands in 92, wasn't it?
It was in 92. I think it was 92, or maybe it was 91 when I first met you.
Okay.
I just started to do that because the mandate kind of from my instructor in Okinawa was to bring Okinawan karate to North America and introduce
and
it.
And
to...
that's another point I want to say to the listeners. There's people who do kata. There's people who perform, and then there's people who do real martial arts performance, of real martial arts, and you fall in that category. I remember how you mesmerized, and I'm not talking about how you dress, because you dress very traditional, but how you perform, how you interact, how you teach, how you pass on the knowledge, and how you tell the story of kata. I've never seen anyone really perform like Scott Hogarth, and take the extreme of dancing, like dancing in the rain, they're going out there and doing it, and Naginata, you know, I'm saying it's pretty amazing. So I can see how you wanted to demonstrate real karate do to the public, especially in open tournaments. Anyway, tell the story how we met. I love it. The boat.
Well, Mr. Gary Lee, I was warming up, and I had my bow with me, and all of a sudden, I was doing a strike, a downward strike, a suki, and the bow snapped in half. And I'm standing there holding two pieces of my bow, and I'm going, oh, no, what do I do now? And I just finished watching.
I said, oh, lucky me. Lucky me, the number one weapons competitor just broke his bow. I'm so lucky.
Well, I looked over at you and I watched you move your bow around, and I thought it was a little bit thin for me, but I thought, okay, I think I can use that. I wonder if you'll let me. So I went up to you and I said, hey, brother, would you mind if I used your bow? And you looked at me and you said, sure, here you go. I took it, I played with it for a bit, and if my memory serves me right, I went out and I did a fairly good bow form. I didn't drop it or throw it around or anything. So, and I think at the end of the day, I think I actually beat you, didn't I?
Yes, you did. My own weapon. But, you know, it was never a toothpick bow. I never used a toothpick bow. I never used a Canadian bow. I always used a traditional bow, but that's a good story. I love that story. But then we went on to Super Grands, and Texas was debuted in Atlantic City, and I got to see you in a different format. I got to see you in a business attitude, taking care of all the competitors in a very professional way attitude. And very impressive because how you handled the rules. And how did you get involved with the NBL, the National Black Belt League, and what led you up to be at the Atlantic City event?
Oh, my God. I talked to Boyce back in the day, and he had this idea of the National Black Belt League to bring everybody together, and what I really liked about it was the international aspect of it, which is what I still enjoy. I still enjoy traveling from country to country competing. But back in the day, that was the one thing that intrigued me. And then he came out with some stuff and rules, and I looked at some of the rules, and I went, well, this doesn't make a ton of sense, boys. I think we need to maybe work on that. And so the next thing I know, he's asking me if he can call me and talk about the rules, and so I can maybe make some changes or put my 50 cents worth in. So the next thing I know, I'm giving them weights for bows and sizes for people and how to judge these things. And I mean, it was just an ongoing thing. And then he asked me after I had done some refereeing for him and did some looking after some tournaments and that kind of thing. He just asked me if I would be the arbitrator. And at first I said, sure. And then he wanted me to be the league arbitrator. So I said, yeah, I was very flattered to do that. And I did it for quite a while. And
Yes,
in between.
Did.
Yeah. Yeah, it was one of those things.
Very proficient at it.
I was very
impressed. In fact, you know, I was the arbitrator for Texas for a few years. Now, you know, Daryl Sir's been doing it now almost 20 years, but
Daryl's a great man. I love the man. He's my fashion consultant, you know. Anything to do with Texas and garments, I talk to him.
Yes. Well, I want to talk about Superman a little bit more because that first one made a big impression on all of us. But do you remember, and this is parts unknown because I love the name of my show, you remember the rivalry between California and Eric Schumann and the Guatemala team? And I was running the center referee for the junior team fighting. You had to make so many tough decisions that night. That was a tough fight, wasn't it?
I do remember that. Eric had a red hot team, but so did California.
Bushido, or what was that guy's name that ran the California team? It wasn't Satch. I forgot who it was. But anyway, those guys, Bushahana, whatever, those guys, man, God, that was a war between the junior team. But they were good. God, but you, I remember you were right smack in the middle because you were the arbitrator. You had to make so many decisions. And dealing with young people, I was so impressed with that. But later on that night in the finals, Boyce decided to do something crazy. He gave away money in one thing. Everything else was medals and plaques before the rings. He gave away medal in one thing. It was called the Creative Forms Challenge. And I remember going up to you and saying, would you please wear your nicest shirt and tie and
Actually, Gary, the first thing you asked me was, can you break fall? And I said, yeah, it's right in my wheelhouse.
Oh, Jesus, I forgot. I'm sorry about saying that. I'm sorry. That gives it away because I just thought you were going to be – I knew you were going to dress up, but I wanted you to wear your nicest shirt. I wanted to win that money. It was only $140, I think, but – and they played what? Remember Born to Be Wild by Steppenwolf.
Yes, they did.
That was fun. Sweeping you, breaking a board over your head, biting a banana, cutting a cucumbers. It was fun. But we took that money. I remember, and Glenn Kwan, rest in peace, Glenn, our dear friend. And what was the Kung Fu guy's name? God, what was his name?
James
Fye. He's from Canada.
James Fye.
Okay, the four of us, we went, and people, if you go to Atlantic City, you have the Atlantic City boardwalk, which is incredible, but you go one block over, you know, it's like walking down a really bad part of town.
Oh, yeah,
and,
well, the inland side of the street is kind of rough, and the outland is kind of modern. It's a very, very strange place, I agree.
I remember walking into a seedy restaurant, restaurant, and we sat there till like 3 in the morning. But do you remember the Goju guys we met? The guys from Peter Urban's Goju guys we met that night?
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah, I do.
I do. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, we met a lot of guys that night. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, but through the years of the NBL, You like you said, you were the arbitrator, you competed, and then one year you did something crazy. I want to talk about this. You went against the grain because you're known to be this hardcore, traditional, no-nonsense, you know, don't do makeup stuff. And you went out there and you went first place, I believe, and you did something crazy. Tell my listeners what you did.
You're not talking
about...
Tell my listeners
what you did.
You're not talking about Gene Kelly, are you?
You beat us all that night. You what?
Gene Kelly?
Yes, you beat us all that night. It blew us away.
Yeah, man. Well, I figured it would be my last performance. I had decided that 2 years competing, and I had won the traditional forms, which is what I really wanted to win, and I'd won it both years back-to-back, like the Blue Jays, 92-93.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say goodbye to everybody and kind of let everybody realize that I'm not all Mr. Traditional and not all Mr. Business. So I came out and did a soft shoe form to Singing in the Rain, a tribute to Gene Kelly, spinning my cane with a top hat on and a bow tie.
I know. It just blew me away. But it showed the talent that he had to be able to, you know, to love martial arts and just conform to the aspect of being an entertainer, not just a martial artist. So it was really cool. And I'm so proud that I got to see that and be a part of that. Now, also through the NBO years, another memory I have, and I don't know if you were a part of this or not. I hope you weren't, but I'm going to bring it up. When Royce created the 4 Ki rule
in
Hollywood, if you remember right, I was the first guy to ever be disqualified with that rule in the traditional kata division. It went kind of crazy that day, and I think I had like 6 or 7 arbitrators trying to calm down myself and Pops and everybody.
Yes, I remember.
But, you know, that's the class that you had to be able to handle the situation. But the story I want to tell the listeners is that night, Boyce asked you and I to be the MC. And remember who he put beside us? The guy's instructor, the instructor of the woman that got in my face that day, and I pushed her away. That was a really hard thing for me to do. You were between me and that guy.
And
Boyce pulled a fast one, but I pulled a fast one on Boyce that night. Michael Chat was the number one rated competitor in NASCAR. And I called up Mike Chat and I said, "Look, Mike, what would it take for you to open up Super Grand?" He says, "I can't do that. Boyce would be so mad." I said, "No, I've got a plane to catch anyway." I said, "No, let me do my magic." So, of course, I didn't ask Boyce. I just called the airline. I made Mike's airline an hour later. And guess, you know, remember who opened up the Super Grands that night? Michael Chat.
Oh, we're right
Boyce
on.
Was so mad at me. He was so mad at me. He didn't talk to me. He wouldn't look at me. He was so mad because I made the number one NASCAR guy open up Super Grands, the NBA Super Grands. So, but it was fun back then, all the things and the excursions. But you went from NBL to getting involved with another group. Tell me a little bit about that group. You're very active in
with the WMO?
WKC, or what is it?
Well, the WMO, the World Martial Arts Organization.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah,
tell
no problem.
That.
It's something that I bit into because I like the concept. I like the concept of keeping old traditional martial arts alive. I like to think back in the heyday when martial arts was spectacular, when you had, you know, magnificent fighters like Joe Louis and Bill Wallace in their prime of time, prime of life. The fighting was spectacular. There was no cheap shots, no stupid back fist to the body, nothing like that. The techniques were remarkable and strong, and that's kind of what the WMO is doing, is keeping the fighting techniques real, as well as the forms and the weapons and that kind of thing. So I'm fairly involved in it now. I'm the Canadian president of the WMO, and Danny Griffith is my vice president, and he's a very special guy, a very special fighter, probably one of the most prolific fighters in the world is Danny Griffith. And we're involved with a guy named Alfie Lewis. I don't know whether you know Alfie or not.
Yes.
But he has a remarkable reputation, but from
great
my
fighter.
Point, of,
yeah, he, yeah, from, England,
from my
right?
point of view, I never really saw him fight. I've seen some of his tapes and stuff.
Yeah.
That's not what's impressing me. What's impressing me is what he's giving back to martial arts and what he's trying to do with the WMO. And the simple fact is that we go and compete with wonderful people from South Africa, from India, from you name it, whatever country is wanting to get involved, we're open to it. But it's old style martial arts. It's the way it was, and I kind of like it like that.
So, what other organizations are in Canada besides the WMO?
Well, there's the WKC, there's the OKF, there's the WKF, there's the CKC, I can go on and on and on and on and on.
Okay, so
we have,
like in the United States, there's many organizations, and I've got a whole show planned on that too. But I'm asking you now, what are the differences? Of course, the difference is the rules, the contact, the
Well, yeah, everybody has their idea. Now, everybody's trying to turn to the WKF because of the Olympic thing going on. Now, let's be real. Not everybody is going to be an Olympic athlete.
Right.
Okay, that's just not going to happen. But everybody should have the opportunity to try to compete on an international
team. Are you
team.
Part of the process of putting together a Canadian team for the 2020 Olympics?
We can be. I have been invited to do that. I've trained some pretty good athletes, so it's in the wheelhouse to do that. I don't know whether that's the direction I want to take, to be very honest. Like I said, that affects a very small percentage of the people, and it's you know, there's a whole lot more people out there doing martial arts. And in my life, anybody that is doing what we do for real deserves respect and consideration. So that's kind of where we're at, and that's kind of the way I'd like to keep doing martial arts and what's happening with the WMO.
Well, I want your opinion on this. A few months back, well, almost a year ago, Robert Young and Floyd Burke from Blood Belt Magazine asked me to write an article on my opinion of what America is going to deal with the Olympics. I don't know if you read it or not, but it was really, they published it. It was really nice. But here's my point. Well, you know, all this year, Taekwondo, Kremlin Shock has been involved with the Olympics, and people have never really seen the fighting of Karate Do. Now they're going to see punches, sweeps, takedowns, supposedly to the WKF level. But here's what I'm really excited about, Scotty, is that for the first time, the world, and you should be too, the world is going to be able to see kata. They're going to be mesmerized by kata. And I'm just excited about thinking that there might be someday, can you imagine the first gold medalist in Black Belt kata for the Olympics? And maybe someday be on the Wheaties box or in a karate uniform. And the other, I mean, that's a possibility. This kata is just, to me, that's the excitement for me to be involved with the Olympics, to watch kata being introduced to the world. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm of two minds on this one, really, completely.
Okay.
One of them is spectacular. Let's get them out there. Let's show people the world and the awesome way things are done. And the other mind I have is the one that is seeing sport karate actually taking over traditional style kata and traditional power and the reality of real martial arts that is taught.
I don't think creative kata would ever be in the Olympics.
No, it won't be. But even the traditional that we see today has been changed, Gary. The traditional that we see today has been changed. They do a lot of posing. The dynamics to the movements are not.
But won't they do mandatory kata? I mean, doesn't that make sense that they do mandatory kata? That means that they can't change. They can't. The judges will know the mandatory katas and the performers
but
the mandatory kata, kind of like the OAAU stuff.
But they've allowed the mandatory katas to change over the years. They've allowed things to slow down. Like I said, poised. One of the guys that really changed the way kata is done in competition is Sakamoto Sensei, and I have great respect for him. He's a wonderful guy, tremendous martial artist. But the way he does his kata is not the way it was done originally. It's not done. It's not done with all the inflection of traditional martial arts. So
you know what? I bet it would be really cool if they had mentorship or they had consultants that would oversee the choice of the mandatory kata. Traditional people that knew exactly what it was, so it wouldn't be changed. That way, they wouldn't accept a change of the creativity of changing a mandatory kata.
Okay.
But they were not going to do that. I know they're not going to do that.
Herein lies the problem with that one. At a certain level, I think most of the masters feel that they
are
have
dead.
The... but they feel that they have the right to change. And because they've gone, then their students feel that they see a certain energy that they see is more strong or more powerful, and they think it should be in the kata or better placement of body movement. So the forms are going to change. It's kind of going to be a metamorphosis over the years. I'm not saying that it's totally a bad thing, but it is at some point changing the reason for doing kata or changing the hidden techniques that kata has presented over all the years. So
let me ask you another question, Scotty. It just makes sense if it's traditional karate do and they're introduced Japanese karate do to the Olympics. Aren't they going to do bunkai also? Are they going to be part of bunkai? Be part of the getting the gold medal or? Or is just a mikata?
You mean purpose?
How do that.
The word you want to use here is purpose. Bunkai kind of just means the movement that they're doing.
The purpose of the okay. So how are they going to describe that when they present that, or are they going to present it in the Olympic event?
Sorry, Gary. Say that again.
I said, how do you think they're going to present the purpose or the, as we know, as bunkai, the application of the kata? How are they going to present that, you believe?
Well, they're going to present it to the way that I've seen them do it, which is they'll pick a technique that goes with that movement and they'll present it. But the problem, of course, I have with all of that is they don't know exactly what that technique was originally, right? I'll just give you, for instance, in some of the kata, if you watch the kicks from the late 60s, 70s, the kicks were a lot more down. There was a lot more Fumakomi-style side kick, which was aimed at the ankles. And over the years, those kicks have raised and gone to the knee, to the waist, to the shoulder, to the head. The reason they were at the ankle was because that was a Dim-Mak technique of breaking the ankle bone and actually hemorrhaging the anterior tibialis artery, which would create Dim-Mak. The chances are this guy's going to bleed to death if he doesn't have that stopped.
Right.
Okay, so
that's the part of Kanapi Do that's the mysterious and unique. It makes it the art and beautiful, and that'll never be displayed or talked about in the Olympics. You're right.
And that's the part that's starting to be lost.
Yes. Yes,
that's
exactly.
That's the part where the people who teach martial arts for the original purpose, which is defense.
But that technique you just shared openly on the air to your buddy here and to the people who are listening and God bless everybody. I remember a technique like that you just shared on the air and exactly how, when, where, and the hit and the technique to hit with, that was not told or shared with at all. That was something that you earned to learn from your sensei. And, you know, I think that's very cool that you shared that with the people to understand that there's something more, but that.
Well, there's way more. The reality is that that's why everybody needs a sensei. That's why Toyama Zenshu is my instructor, because he gives me these things. He's been helping me decipher reality from myth and reality from people's conjecture for years. That's why I'm still with him. I love him to death because he really gave me a path of reality that I wouldn't ever leave. So that's why I'm still with him.
I tell them I get a true master of, I say, overall karate do. And I talk to a lot of sport karate heroes and champions and stuff, but to me, you're more than that. You're what I call a deep sensei. So I'm going to ask you something very personal. You know, with all the accolades that you've accomplished and who you are to the world and to the karate world and to the sport karate world, I'm going to ask you, Scotty, how do you stay so humble? Because I've known you for many years now, and you've not really changed. You're kind of like what Mr. Norris was when I met him when I was 16. In all these years, he's never changed. You're the same way. You've never changed. You've always stayed so completely humble. How do you do that? Explain it to my listeners. I know it's meditation. I know it's meditation. I know it's the love of the martial arts. I know your family life is very deep. And I know that you love your sensei and your karate-do. But tell me, just share it with me. How do you stay so humble? It's a personal question, but I'm going to ask you. Please, share with me.
I guess it's real simple from my perspective, Gary. Everybody deserves my respect. There isn't anybody in this world that doesn't deserve my respect until they do something that is completely off kilter for humanity. So I'm nobody special, and neither is anybody else. We're all the bloody same. We just see the world from our own eyes, so we have our own aspect of how we see things. Nobody's any better than anybody else, and the second you start thinking that, we have a problem in the world. And the problem right now is ridiculous. Everybody needs to start just loving everybody else and understanding what they do, and everybody is special. You are a very special human being. The first time I met Gary Lee, wow, buddy, you cracked me up. I watched this guy move. I watched the power. I watched the focus. But the biggest thing that I saw come out of you was your Budo spirit.
Thank you.
Everything that you did was about the Budo spirit. And
thank you.
You know, you talked about it, the integrity, keeping it true, keeping it real. The thing I love about Texas is real simple. You guys work hard. You're real martial artists. You do what is required, and that's hard work, and just keep doing it. It's an everyday thing, and when I went to Texas and I met all these people, George Minshew and all these wonderful Pat Burleson, all these wonderful people, spectacular. Spectacular just
well,
to be there with you.
We're going to talk about a couple of those guys, and we're going to play the Legends name game when I come back. If you can just hang on just a few minutes, I'm going to do a couple shout-outs and a commercial or two, and I'll be back with you in just a moment, and we'll play the Legends name game. Is that cool, Scotty?
That'll be fun. Absolutely.
Okay, hang loose, buddy. Hang loose.
Thanks, Gary.
A couple minutes. Okay.
Bye,
hey, we're with Scott Hogarth in Canada, superstar and a legendary performer. The first arbitrator for the National Bobsled League, actually a choreographer and consultant for movies, the president of the WMO, as we're listening to, just a great guy and just so much fun talking to him because we have a great history, but we'll be back with him in just a few minutes. Big shout out to our Karate Studio of the Week. This is a segment that we've added onto our program, and this week's shout out is to someone I'm very proud to know of, and just opened his brand new location in Dickinson, which was hit by Hurricane Harvey, but it's got a new beautiful location. I'm talking about Mr. Al Garza at Premier's Martial Arts in League City in Dickinson. And, you know, he teaches Krav Maga, he teaches karate, he teaches kickboxing. It's a very spiritually based karate studio, very family oriented. I've known Mr. Garza since he was a brown belt, and now I believe that he's like an 8th degree black belt and a leader in the area of martial arts and around the Dickinson and Lake City area. For more information, to call and talk to Al personally, and you heard about him on the shout out, you call him directly at 281-332-5425, and that's Premier Martial Arts. Al Garza's Premier Martial Arts in League City in Dickinson, Texas. And that's our shout out. If you'd like to be on the shout out, just email me at ProfessorGaryLee@gmail.com, and we'll do a shout out in the studio in which you offer, and put your phone number out there. And it doesn't cost anything. We just do it because we want to help out the community and tell people about martial arts. And remember, if we endorse you, you're being endorsed by the Sport Karate Museum. That's a 5-star endorsement. So God bless you. And remember, check out Al Garza's Premier Martial Arts, 281-332-5425. Now, the segment that we've also added back, which people really, really like, and I like doing it, is our mail out and our mail out shout out. And this is our mails that we get in. And I appreciate every email. I answer every one, believe it or not, as busy as I am, and I'm very busy. I love answering the emails, no matter how simple or how complicated the question is. And the fun part is picking out the one for each week's show. So tonight, this comes from Hansville, Montana. And I looked that up. It's a small little place in Montana. But nonetheless, it comes from William Lester. And he asked, he asked me to explain. Explain the face contact rule. I'm so confused. Face contact, no face contact, light touch. I'm so confused. What is the deal? Wow. Well, you know, face contact. I remember, well, I didn't fight at the time in the 60s in America, but I remember when face contact was just part of the game because it was part of the development of sport karate. And then they realized that the best of lips, the broken noses, the best of eyes, the blood wasn't really necessary, so they believed in developing a control technique, taking the weapon from Tomashi and making it be upon a control technique to say close enough to hit but not hit, to pull it just as it was going to touch. Of course, they made a rule. If you did touch, then it had to be light contact. Well, what is light contact? Where it didn't show a contusion, there's no blood, or no redness. When blood came, I remember in Texas, blood wasn't a factor until 1984. Up at that point, if you cut someone a busted nose or there's blood factor, you just threw him a towel and you went on if he could get back up. In 1984 in Texas, blood was a factor, so if there was any blood whatsoever, you were disqualified. And that was before arbitrational duties. And then, of course, in the 90s, when arbitrators were invented, they constantly make a decision, blood was absolutely a factor. There's no blood whatsoever. So contact, face contact, it's really a touchy subject to so many different organizations. And a lot of organizations, they do tournaments where you can come within like a foot away from the face and you can get a point. I know that sounds crazy, but that's just the way it is. And then, of course, some tournament circuits, if you don't actually touch the face, then you'll never get a point. So, you know, it really depends on the circuit that you support. And my suggestion is don't be confused. Just support the tournament circuit that you feel that you're most enjoyable working with. And if you like face contact, go for it. If you don't, then find a circuit that doesn't allow it. But, hey, William, I hope you stay in sport karate and enjoy it as much as we have in all our life. So, you know, the neat thing about this radio show is that we always introduce exciting things, and one of the exciting things I like to talk about is the upcoming events that are coming up. And July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, Hunter Jesse Bowen, Mr. Jim Buten, myself, Mr. Jim Butcher, and we're working on getting Mr. J. Pat Burleson there. We'll be in the Sport Karate Museum booth at the Super Show at the Bellagio this year, and that's July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. So make sure if you'd like to if you'd be in Vegas, if you'd like to come to Vegas and have a vacation, come visit us July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd at the Bellagio at the Super Show at the Sport Karate Museum booth. And a big shout out to Century Fitness and our dear friend, Mr. Mike Dillard, who supports the Sport Karate Museum. God bless you guys, and we'll see you then. Hey, I'd like to come back to my super guest, the one and only Mr. Scotty Hogarth. Scotty, are you there?
I am, sir.
Hey, little brother. Have you ever been to the Super Show before?
No, I have not. I've been invited several times, but I have not.
You know, my dear friend, he's writing the screen, or working on the screenplay with my movie, Dana Abbott. I'd love to get you guys in the same room together. Have you ever met Dana Abbott?
I certainly have. I met him at the Masters. We had a great time.
You guys,
Masters Hall of Fame. Dana's a wonderful guy. He's a good swordsman, and I like his being. He's very cool.
He's a Jack Benny of samurais. He's happy-go-lucky. He's a warrior. Yeah, he's been my friend since the late 80s, man. Just a great guy. But, you know, hey, the Super Show is a great event. And, you know, Century always takes care of the Sport Karate Museum. But I'd love to see.
Yeah, I got to give a shout out to Michael Dillard Jr. What a great guy. He's been helping the WMO Canada with the equipment and stuff like that. He's helped sponsor us. He's given us some great deals. And he's a true gentleman. He's a man of his word. So I have nothing but complete respect, and it's wonderful that
Century does that. Are you talking about Mike Dillard's son? Mike Dillard Jr., right?
Yeah, Mike Dillard's son, yes.
Yes, great guy, super guy. You know, go ahead.
He looks after me, man, and like I said, it's all in the same group. Where I sat there in the Masters Hall of Fame with Mike Dillard Sr., and we had a good talk and conversation. We were with Jeff and Smith and the rest of the guys. We had a great time.
You know,
I
got to tell you this, little brother. You know, when I did Jack Wong's Memorial Roast this year, and I actually went up there to Oklahoma. And Mrs. Wong brought me in. I did the big roast, and it was really, you know, honoring Jack Wong, the great Jack Wong. Well, I got stuck up there because of Harvey. Literally lived in the hotel for a week. Guess he run me around and took care of me, took me to dinner and lunch, and this was my friend. It was Mike Dillard. He's him and Jim Buten. But Mike Dillard is such a great guy. And this year, he got to experience the legends. He actually came in to the Living Legends, and he went through the museum, and he spent an hour and a half in the museum, Scotty. And I'm telling you, Mike Dillard is the real deal. I have
no doubt.
Yeah,
hey, you've done a great job.
Yeah, he cares. That's what I'm trying to say. I can talk about him all night long. All I can say is that he really cares about the history of sport karate. I know he does. So, hey, here, just play the Legends name game, buddy.
Okay, let's go.
Names at you. And I'm gonna. You tell me about them for 2 minutes, just like a fight, and then we'll go on. I want to hit about five or six names. You ready?
Yeah.
I'm ready for the first one, and who's a dear friend of ours, Glenn Kwan.
Oh man! First thing that pops up is my brother. He and I, he was part of the Fighting Griffin, which I started many years ago, back 1970 something or other. I don't want to think how long ago. And he was part of that. We always worked well together. He was so influential. His Kempo karate was excellent. He trained a lot of really good people. His Dai Senpai is Michelle Macy's. She was part of my team this year that went to Ireland, and she won gold medals. His legacy is going to carry on for a long, long time. He will be remembered very fondly from everybody. And from me, I remember road trips. I remember him spilling coffee on every clean gi he ever had. I remember, Scotty,
I remember this. I remember whenever he would judge me, he would bow out because he didn't want to judge me. He would coach me. Isn't that
yeah.
cool?
Well, he felt really close to you, Gary. He didn't want to judge you.
I thought it was so cool. I loved it. Okay, Glenn Kwan, rest in peace, little brother. I got to hit you with another Canadian, someone that I really love. I don't love him, but I respect him very deeply because I saw him just mesmerize people when he was the first president of NASCA. I'm talking about Mr. Cesar Burkowski.
Well, Cesar's a fantastic guy. He's the real deal. He trains very hard himself. He has a high level of skill that he wants his students to achieve. He's amassed an amazing number of students. He has 12 clubs across Toronto, all run by excellent martial artists. I have nothing to say except he's really shown what an amazing job he can do and has done with martial arts in Ontario. He's really hit the ball right out of the park, and anybody that says different doesn't know, period. They don't know what he's done. And he's made some good connections in Okinawa.
And I keep in touch with him through Facebook, and I really admire the fact that he's a part of the Sport Karate Museum and being a history general. And speaking of someone who's another Canadian who lives in another country, I believe he's coming back to the United States. But very instrumental in my career, made me an historian in this Riki Society, You know, talk about Patrick McCarthy. Tell me about Patrick.
Oh, wow. Well, Patrick McCarthy's like a childhood friend, man. When I was going through high school, I knew all about Patrick McCarthy and his amazing spin kicks. And he could jump up in the air and take a cigarette out of a guy's mouth. I do believe he missed once or twice, but I've known Pat a long time.
His Okinawa history and his Okinawa influence on the world, what he's done.
It's more Japanese. He started in mainland Japan, and he went through that way, the Butokukai, and then across, then into Okinawa. And then he studied there under several instructors.
Were childhood friends?
Yeah, man. Yeah, like
wow.
I knew of him. I wasn't a childhood friend of his, but I knew of him when I was a kid. And one of his best friends was my best friend. So we hung in the same category, right in the West End of Toronto. So,
Let me ask you a question, little brother. When my grandkids grow up, and hopefully I'm still here, and they ask me, Grandpa, how important is that Ryukyu Historian Society Award from that Patrick McCarthy? What should I tell them from your perspective?
How important is it? I think it's absolutely
for him to
essential.
Choose the museum to honor it. I mean, how important that is that?
Absolutely essential that we remember our past, because if we don't, we're going to make mistakes in our future. So it's essential that we do that. One of the things that Patrick does is he keeps the essence of Karate Do alive. I've watched him teach, and he's very entertaining and enthralling. Everybody is really hooked when he starts teaching. Everybody is hooked in. He's just a great guy. He knows his stuff, and he has the ability to speak Japanese, which helps. And he can really do the job. He's been doing amazing. He's written so many articles and books, and he's, you know, translated some of the amazing texts, the Bubishi.
I got to share this with you because, you know, I feel like I'm looking at your eyes and I'm holding your hand. And that's like we always do when we're together. You know, we talk from the heart. So I got to tell you this. I got a call from Uncle Sid, you know, Sid Campbell, before he passed. And he said, Gary, I had a long talk and lunch with Patrick McCarthy in Oakland. And I said, he's going to call you. And I go, yes, sir. And, of course, you know, we lost Uncle Sid, and I never got a call. And then finally I got a call. And I get a call from Mr. McCarthy. And we talk, and I never forget what he told me. Scotty goes, Sid took my hand and put both his hands on my hand. And he said, you got to promise me something. And Mr. McCarthy said, yes, I will, Sid. And I guess he was sharing with him that, you know, he had the big C and stuff. And he said, you got to promise me you'll always take care of Gary. You'll take care of Gary Lee. And, you know, I actually never didn't know Mr. McCarthy, just through competition. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got the call and he told me that, it really made me feel special that Uncle Sid always thought of me, but to have Mr. McCarthy do what he did. So I know what that award means. I'm just sharing this with you because I love you, Scott. I just want you to know what you mean to me. You know, but
that's very special, man. And you're talking about people that are very special. Like Patrick's very focused on what he does, and not only that, he's raised a family. He's a family man. He looks after himself. He's a very special guy, and he has a mission, and his mission is.
Well, I hope he comes to the United States. I know he's been trying to come here, and. I mean, actually, we wrote letters and, you know, the way he's doing, and he's been keeping up and been sending me stuff. So I hope he gets to come here. But let's go down to Texas. Let's go talk about someone we're both very close to. I just roasted George Minshew.
I wish I was there for that roast. God, I love George. George is spectacular.
Amy, he's cool.
He is so much fun. I mean, I stood on the side of the pyramids in Mexico City.
Yeah.
Right? And I've been to Rio Dulce and the Seven Altars and with George and Chris. We toured together. I've spent a lot of time with them. His family is very special to me. George is the real deal. He cares about martial arts, but he cares about people more. And I know he has a relationship with Gary Lee that's pretty special. There's no negative to George. He's my brother. I love him. I love his family. What can I say?
Cool. Hey, let's talk about your friend that you associate with, and he's your vice president. Because you said earlier, I know how great a fighter he is, but tell the listeners how great a fighter he really is. I'm talking about Danny Griffith.
Danny Griffith moves like he's got silk underwear on, man. This guy is this guy is incredible. He is so smooth, and he is probably, from my perspective, the best off-time fighter I've ever seen anywhere in the world. He marches to his own tune. Therefore, when he gets in the ring, he's hard to hit. And he has a way of hitting you when he wants to. I've watched him teach many, many hours. I've watched him compete many, many times. In fact, when I took ill in Texas, he came to my bedside, and he was supposed to fight in an hour. I said, "What the hell are you doing here, man?" I said, "Get up and get going." He said, "No, man, I can't go anywhere. I want to make sure you're okay."
Yeah, you scared the crap out of us that time, and everyone thought, well, you did actually have a heart attack, did you?
I didn't have a heart attack. I had a heart cramp. My potassium levels dropped out so much because I got very angry at some little man that I wished I had just hit instead of got angry at.
Yeah. I wouldn't want you angry at me.
But he insulted my wife, and my wife is very special to me. And I love her very much.
Don't forget about Tammy. I want to talk about Tammy. She's a great martial artist. But how long have you been with Tammy? And tell me a little about Tammy.
Well, we've been together over 25 years. Our last anniversary was 20 years together. But one of the most amazing things about Tammy with martial arts is when I first met her, she was on two crutches. She was told she'd never get any better.
I remember that story, yes.
She has a thing called RSD, a sympathetic dystrophy. And she had been hurt in an accident, and it messed up her hips and her leg and extreme pain. So I was with her for 4 years before she ever started to train, and then she came to me one day and she said, "I want to train, I want to do this." So I gave her into the hands of one of my very capable black belts, Sandy Graham. And Sandy took her under her wing and started teaching her. Well, the rest is history. We were in Atlanta, Georgia for the Super Grands. And she went down and entered the highest Q belt division of the SKI, whatever it was back in the day, ski. And she won the entire division, and it wasn't an AWAD division. It wasn't an athlete with a disability division. It was a regular division. And she beat 40 people to win that division.
Wow.
And cool. I was so impressed, right? Martial arts has done amazing things for her. One of the most spectacular moments in my life was when she went to Okinawa 3 years ago and was graded to her fifth degree black belt from Sensei Toyama. She did San Chin, and I could see the connection in her hips and in her body that we could never see before, because she couldn't do it because of her disability. And she managed to do it. Wow, holy cow.
I know she's very special.
I had tears, man. It blew me away. It was like, wow, check that out. Holy.
Yeah.
Very special.
Very special. Well, I'm going to I'll have one more person I'd like to talk about, because he's very special to me. And I'm just curious how well you knew him, or I know you know of him, and I'm talking about Keith Weston.
Well, Keith has my Subarito. I trained Keith Weston for a bit. He has my my Subarito. He used it. He was doing some sword work.
Tell me what a Subarito is.
A Subarito is a weighted club that Miyamoto Musashi would have used at the end of his life to kill people with. It's a samurai sword, but it's a true weight. And
Miyamoto Musashi was the greatest swordsman that ever lived, according to the folklore. Over 80 kills with just a bokken. But to give something of that prestige to someone, what does Keith Weston mean to you? And I'll share with you a story too, but you go ahead and tell me.
Well, Keith actually was working and training, and I saw some really good stuff in him. We competed together in Galveston.
Yes.
We competed together a few times in the NBL. It was kind of like a fun time. I saw some pretty spectacular qualities in Keith, and I thought, well, you know, I trained him a little bit with the sword, and I gave him my Subarito, so he's had it ever since.
That's so cool. Well, let me share this with you. The first Kumite Classic, which is Bill Viola's tournament, the very first one, people were running up to me, and that's when I was introducing Black Belt TV. And they said, Mr. Lee, I was there with Butch, you know, Tegasala. And they said, do you know who Keith Weston is? I said, no, I think I've heard of Keith Weston. And, of course, from that moment on, you know, because Billy had a traditional division separate from the regular open division in fighting, not just kata, but in fighting too. So this was a handful of us that were doing the traditional fighting. And we all fell in love with each other, Butch and I and Keith, and through the competition traveling, it became very special. But my favorite story of Keith, Brother Scotty, is that it's not a good memory, but it's a positive memory in the sense of what I saw. You know, it's the time when he lost his father. And we was in the hotel room, and we were experiencing getting ready to go on stage, and he did something really spectacular that night. I don't know if you heard about it or not. That was the night that he broke the glass and put it on the stage and did his kata on broken glass, and he dedicated it to his dad that night. I've never seen a display of kata in open competition that way before. It was just really very special. But Keith Weston is a very special individual, as you said. I'm glad you shared that with me, because I didn't realize how close you were to him. That's very special.
Oh yeah. One of his girlfriends was one of our very good friends. She lived in London now. They're not together anymore, and she got married and had a great life as well. But back in the day, we had all kinds of fun. And like I said, we played on the beach in Galveston. I think I pushed him into the water, actually.
You know, we used to slap each other. Remember that? I mean,
oh, yeah.
And you know, when I get slapped by Keith Weston, it wasn't a slap. It'd be such a psych up back then, you know?
Hey, the person that shocked me with slapping was Benny the Jet. I trained with him about 4 hours in 100-degree temperature, and we did this numbing slapping routine. Good Lord.
Really?
Oh, my God.
I interviewed him about 4 weeks ago. He's a great guy. Great guy.
He numbed me big time. Oh, yeah, he is a great guy. We went out and bought him a pair of cowboy boots.
That is
from Canada,
funny.
No less.
That's funny. Hey, listen, as we wrap up the show, I want to ask you one important question that's really important to me personally, and also to the listeners who love sport karate history. You've been involved from the beginning of the Sport Karate Museum idea and the vision of the museum. How important is that for you to be involved in the work that we've all done as history generals, but the work I do every day? How important is that, you believe, to the future of sport karate?
Well, I've said it already once, and I'll say it again. If we don't know where we've come from, we're going to get lost in where we're going. We need to keep some of it real. We need to keep martial arts a part of what we do. Like, one of my peeves is too much baton twirling and not enough real working the bow. If I see the changes in martial arts, sometimes we have to go back to the root. I would love to go to a tournament that was all traditional, as much as I would love to go to a tournament that was all modern. There's a place for everyone and everything, but we need to keep it organized so that we remember, so that we appreciate what once was real. You can't step too far out of the box, because if you do, you're going to lose the original intent, right? So that's quite the question. What do I think? I think that what you're doing is 100% right, and everybody should do their part to take care of our history.
Well, God bless you, and I appreciate that answer. And
right.
I can't thank you enough for your time tonight. I told you that the hour and 15 minutes should go by quickly, and but it was fun.
There's only two things. There's only two things. Sorry, man. There's only two things I gotta say.
Sure.
The first thing is I gotta send my love to Texas and everybody in Texas for Rooster.
Well,
I gotta say that because I met this man and I thought, wow, I loved his energy. I loved how he treated me. You can always tell what a man is by the way he treats others, and he was very special. So my sympathy and my condolences and my love to all my friends in Texas. Big shout out to Jose Santa Maria and Tony Lopez and all my friends. And a very Merry Christmas to everybody, because I'm going to say very Merry Christmas. That may not be politically correct, but I'm not politically correct.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Scott Hogarth, and Tammy, and all of Canada, and everybody we talked about tonight. And I can't thank you enough for being on the show tonight. So I'm going to see if Hansi Bowen is there. Are you there, sir, or did we leave you? Are you there, sir? Well, it looks like Hansi Bowen has left the studio. So with that said, God bless everybody. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas to everyone. And remember, next week we'll be with Solera Key, the student of John Sharkey and Leo Fong. And our end show of the year will be with Mr. Goldie Mack and talking about all the incredible people that we've interviewed. And from all of us at the AMAA Masters Radio and Pioneer Show, we say good night, we say mahalo, and we say aloha.
Mahalo.
Mahalo, brother.
Mahalo.